From NPR News, this is live special coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address, along with the Republican response from Senator Marco Rubio of Florida. I'm Melissa Block. In just a moment, President Obama will make his way through the House chamber. From the rostrum, he'll deliver a speech that amounts to his vision for his second term. And that vision is expected to focus largely on the nation's struggling economy. In short, jobs and how to create them. I'm joined now by NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson and NPR congressional correspondent Tamara Keith. And Tamara, let's start with you. We've been watching the justices of the Supreme Court filing in. The First Lady and Dr. Biden, wife of the vice president, are here along with a number of guests. Tell us about your vantage point and what you see.
Well, and just now the cabinet members are walking in with John Kerry coming in first and getting lots of greetings from folks since he just ascended from this chamber to the cabinet. I'm seated in the gallery, sort of stage left, overlooking the chamber. And just to my left in one of these galleries is Gabrielle Giffords, Representative Gabrielle Giffords, and her husband, Mark Kelly.
The former representative from Arizona.
Who was shot while doing a congresswoman on your corner event. And she and her husband and their daughters are wearing green ribbons. There are a lot of people in this chamber tonight wearing green ribbons. Those are in honor of Newtown. And Democratic members here in the House have made a very concerted effort to make gun violence an issue. It will no doubt come up in the speech, but they want to make sure that their presence is felt. And you can see these green ribbons all over the chamber on lapels. They've invited gun violence victims and gun violence survivors to be their guests here, and you can see them all around.
And we're waiting for the House Sergeant-at-Arms, Paul Irving, to announce the president as he makes his way into the House chamber. Tamara, in the past, there's been some bipartisan seatmates, right? Republicans and Democrats trying to find common ground, at least in the seating chart for the speech. Are we seeing that tonight as well?
I have to say there isn't that much of it. It's definitely not as obvious or as present as it has been in past years. You know, there are, I see a few Republicans sitting over on the Democratic side and a few Democrats sitting over on the Republican side, though those members seem to be the ones who showed up 9 hours ago to get a good aisle seat, and they were perfectly happy to take an aisle on the right side of the chamber.
Okay, let's bring Mara Liasson into the conversation as we wait for the president to make his entrance into the chamber. Mara, a lot of questions about whether we're going to be hearing an emboldened President Obama in this State of the Union address tonight, the same sort of rhetoric that we heard in his inaugural address just a few weeks ago.
Right. Republicans feel that he was very aggressive when he laid out his progressive vision in the inaugural address. They felt that he neglected to offer an olive branch to the other side, that he backed away from reforming entitlements, and really did deliver a full-throated liberal vision of activist government. I think what they're waiting to hear in this address is whether the tone stays the same or whether he does reach across the aisle and what he says about compromising.
And in terms of specifics of the themes that we expect the president to be hitting tonight, what are you hearing?
Well, we're going to hear a lot about the middle class, job creation, how to make the economy more robust, how to get Americans the skills they need, how to get American businesses the skilled workers they need, why education and energy are important to that, to economic growth, and how cutting the deficit fits into that vision. He told House Democrats at a retreat last week that he thinks that giving everyone a fair shot is not just a fairness or an equity issue, it's actually a growth issue. It's a growth agenda.
Sounds very much like a lot of the themes we heard all through the campaign, the presidential campaign.
Well, it worked for him then, and he's certainly not given up on it now. I think he's a president who's very confident. He feels reelected. He thinks the public's behind him, and he thinks his opposition is divided.
Tamara, two other issues, the immigration being one, guns being another, where there are moves toward legislation, some bipartisan moves toward legislation on both those issues.
Absolutely. I think that immigration is one where there have been some very strong bipartisan coalitions that have come forward with at least frameworks of a potential agreement. Though, as they said when they announced those frameworks, that the devil is in the details. And one big question is the path to citizenship, whether there will be one or not, or what form it would take, or how long the line would be to get in to have that path. And that is something that will be worked out over the weeks and months here. But it does seem that on both sides of the aisle, there is a strong desire to get that done. On gun violence, there are, it's a very divided chamber, and very much divided, even within the Democratic Party. There are conservative Democrats and red state Democrats who will struggle with this. But there are some elements that seem to be gaining some bipartisan support, some traction, including the idea of more robust background checks, potentially universal background checks. And then as you start going down the line to things like limiting the size of ammunition magazines or an assault weapons ban, those get much more challenging politically very quickly.
And hanging over all of this, Tamara, is the specter of the sequester, the across-the-board spending cuts that are set to take effect on March 1st.
First the sequester, then the question of whether the government will be funded or whether there will be some kind of standoff over that and a government shutdown. And then after that, the debt limit comes up again. We are here in Washington in sort of a rolling crisis that just one fiscal fight after another. It's sort of like battles all part of the same war, and it turns out no one's winning. But everyone is positioning, trying to gain political advantage, and absolutely that is hanging over this, and is really the next fight on the horizon is the sequester, these across-the-board spending cuts. And there's a lot of blame going around trying to pin the sequester, the spending cuts, on the Republicans and pin it on the president. The reality on some level is that was this thing that was created that was supposed to never happen. It was so bad. And now the gridlock here makes it look like it's very possible it will happen.
Mara, are you hearing much the same, that seems to be more and more a foregone conclusion that the sequester will happen, or is there a path out?
That part of the sequester will happen. A lot of people are resigned to seeing some kind of automatic cuts. There are a lot of Republicans who think that's one way to get spending cut. But I would be surprised if the sequester goes into effect lock, stock, and barrel and nothing is done to provide an alternative to it.
We might be part in that phase, in these sort of rolling crises, we might be in that phase where everyone says, oh my God, it's totally going to happen. And then in a few weeks, we'll get that miraculous deal and everyone will be excited because there was a deal. We could be in that phase. It's just not clear. But we're definitely at that time where everyone is saying, it seems inevitable.
We have seen that before.
We have seen this movie many times.
Yes. Let's go ahead and bring our senior Washington editor, Ron Elving, into the conversation as we wait for President Obama to enter the House chamber for his State of the Union address. Ron, talk a bit about presidential second terms. We know that this president studies presidential history, thinks back on his predecessors. What does past practice show?
Past practice shows that a president needs to get something accomplished in the first year or at most 2 years of a second term, because after that, the gravitational pull of the next presidential election and the aging of his own public appeal combine to really make it difficult for that president to do much. Now, there have been exceptions to this, and we have seen presidents come back in the seventh and eighth years of their presidency to do significant things, but usually in response to historic events. So while the president is actually setting the agenda, while the president is trying to accomplish something of his own choosing as opposed to responding to events, we're really looking at the fifth and sixth years, and that's why the president needs to seize the initiative at this stage of his presidency with speeches such as his second inaugural and then this speech tonight.
And we're looking at a president with a cabinet that has gone through quite a bit of upheaval. We now have a new Secretary of State, John Kerry, who is in the chamber not as a senator but as the Secretary of State, potentially Chuck Hagel, a Secretary of Defense, a number of other transitions. What do those shifts mean, do you think, for policy going forward?
Some of it is going to be the continuation of the policies of the first term, but I don't think we'll see a huge change between John Kerry, for example, and Hillary Clinton. But some of it is probably going to be setting out on some new directions, and Chuck Hagel might be an example of that.
And we are awaiting the House Sergeant of Arms, who will be announcing the President of the United States to deliver the State of the Union address for 2013. Members of Congress still milling about. They've not taken their seats. There's a lot of chatting going on in the House chamber as they wait for the president. Mara Liasson, you've seen many, many of these State of the Union addresses, and there's a ritual to all of this. The walking down the aisle, the shaking of hands.
Right. The people who've camped out like Elliot Engel since 10 in the morning. You get in the picture with the president if you sit on the aisle. And we're watching pictures of the first lady in the gallery. And, of course, she always has special guests with her. And each one of them is chosen
and
to make a particular
point. And here is the House Sergeant at Arms.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
And the president has now entered the chamber. We have Speaker of the House John Boehner and Vice President Joe Biden at the dais, who will be seated behind the president as he delivers his remarks. He's now, President Obama, making his way through the chamber, shaking those hands that Mara Liasson was talking about. And again, those aisle seats are much coveted and much staked out early in the day.
Yes, and people who make it a practice of staking them out and sitting in them say they get tremendous response from their constituents when they've seen them shaking the president's hand, giving him a hug. So it pays off.
It pays off, or it can backfire, depending on the first political
persuasion.
Well,
you persuasion. Wouldn't sit
yes.
there if it's going to backfire.
But it has backfired for some. And they do apparently practice what they're going to say in their 5 seconds with the president rather assiduously.
Right, or less.
Ron, talk a little bit about the history of this address and what it has come to mean, what it comes to symbolize.
It goes back. It goes back to George Washington, who gave the first one. And after a couple of presidents.
A very short one.
A very short one. 1,000 words. 1,000 words. Just almost a few brief remarks, really. Although memorable, as many of his speeches were, he chose his words carefully. And then Thomas Jefferson decided that the whole idea of doing the thing live and in person was really a bit too imperial. So he moved away from it and started sending a written State of the Union address, although they didn't call it that at the time, just a report on the state of things in the country. And then when we got to the more modern era, Woodrow Wilson decided to come back and start delivering it in front of the Congress in person. Calvin Coolidge, although he was known by the name Silent Cal, was the first one to be heard over the radio by the whole
Silent
country.
No More.
Silent No More. And then Harry Truman, of course, took it into TV land in 1947, which was also the first speech where it was popularly referred to as the State of the Union, and it's been called that ever since.
Tamara Keith, from your vantage point, looking out over the chamber as the president makes his way through, what can you tell about the mood of the room?
You know, I see a lot of smiles down there. Well, certainly on the Democratic side, I see a lot of smiles. On the Republican side, I see members reviewing, I believe, the prepared remarks that they've been given. It's a very colorful scene, lots of smiles, the president giving lots of hugs and kisses on the cheek as he walks down that aisle, shaking, I would say, up to 3 hands in each row.
And this is both working both sides of the aisle.
Absolutely.
This is a speech also, Tamara, where there are a lot of people who have been trying to shoehorn their particular points of interest into this speech to get some mention of their pet project or their passion.
Absolutely, and we will see. It seems as though he will be covering a pretty broad expanse of issues, there are certainly people here in this chamber who want to hear their issues and are hoping that they'll come up.
The president is getting ever closer to the dais where he'll be delivering his State of the Union address, still making his way through, heading towards, I believe, his cabinet as he works his way down the aisle.
And I will say I see members on both sides of the aisle, Republican members. I see Daryl Issa right now from California snapping a picture on his iPhone of the president walking in.
One study in contrasts, Melissa, is the facial expression on Speaker John Boehner, who is, of course, the Speaker of the House and the host here.
Yes.
And then, of course, Joe Biden, who is on the dais next to John Boehner because he is the president of the Senate by virtue of being vice president of the United States. And through much of this ceremony up to now, Boehner has not looked too pleased and maybe just a little bit sour, whereas Joe Biden, as usual, is beaming Joe.
And we may expect more of the same throughout the address as the jumping up and down in applause or lack thereof takes place during the speech. It will be the speaker, actually, who introduces the president. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. And we're moments away from that happening. Mara Liasson, about how long a speech are we expecting here?
Well, it's hard to tell because, of course, applause really lengthens it, but it's only about 37 minutes as written. But they can stretch all the way to an hour, depending on how many ovations he gets. And sometimes, we didn't last time when they decided to sit in a bipartisan manner, but sometimes you get the kind of seesaw effect with the president's own party jumping to their feet and applauding while the opponents sit on their hands, the opposition party sits on their hands.
Yeah.
We don't know what
part of the room standing,
right.
part of it sitting. The president has reached the dais, I believe. He is shaking hands with his vice president, Joe Biden, and with the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, and turning to address the room. And as Tamara mentioned, a lot of green ribbons in that room commemorating the victims of the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, at Sandy Hook Elementary School.
Thank you. Thank you. Do I give me food right now?
You do.
Members of Congress, I have the high privilege and distinct honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
Thank you. Thank you.
The President has handed copies of his speech to the Vice President and Speaker Boehner. They will have copies as he delivers his remarks to Congress. He is getting a standing ovation from at least some of the members in that chamber.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Please, everybody have a seat. Mr. Speaker, Mr. Vice President, members of Congress, fellow Americans. 51 years ago, John F. Kennedy declared to this chamber that the Constitution makes us not rivals for power, but partners for progress. It is my task, he said, to report the State of the Union. To improve it is the task of us all. Tonight, thanks to the grit and determination of the American people, there is much progress to report. After a decade of grinding war, our brave men and women in uniform are coming home. After years of grueling recession, our businesses have created over 6 million new jobs. We buy more American cars than we have in 5 years, and less foreign oil than we have in 20. Our housing market is healing, our stock market is rebounding, and consumers, patients, and homeowners enjoy stronger protections than ever before. So, together, we have cleared away the rubble of crisis. And we can say with renewed confidence that the state of our union is stronger. But we gather here knowing that there are millions of Americans whose hard work and dedication have not yet been rewarded. Our economy is adding jobs, but too many people still can't find full-time employment. Corporate profits have skyrocketed to all-time highs, but for more than a decade, wages and incomes have barely budged. It is our generation's task, then, to reignite the true engine of America's economic growth, a rising, thriving middle class. It is our unfinished task to restore the basic bargain that built this country, the idea that if you work hard and meet your responsibilities, you can get ahead, no matter where you come from, no matter what you look like or who you love. It is our unfinished task to make sure that this government works on behalf of the many and not just the few, that it encourages free enterprise, rewards individual initiative, and opens the doors of opportunity to every child across this great nation. The American people don't expect government to solve every problem. They don't expect those of us in this chamber to agree on every issue. But they do expect us to put the nation's interests before party. They do expect us to forge reasonable compromise where we can. For they know that America moves forward only when we do so together, and that the responsibility of improving this union remains the task of us all. Now, our work must begin by making some basic decisions about our budget, decisions that will have a huge impact on the strength of our recovery. Over the last few years, both parties have worked together to reduce the deficit by more than $2.5 trillion, mostly through spending cuts, but also by raising tax rates on the wealthiest 1% of Americans. As a result, we are more than halfway towards the goal of $4 trillion in deficit reduction that economists say we need to stabilize our finances. Now we need to finish the job. And the question is, how? In 2011, Congress passed a law saying that if both parties couldn't agree on a plan to reach our deficit goal, about $1 trillion worth of budget cuts would automatically go into effect this year. These sudden, harsh, arbitrary cuts would jeopardize our military readiness. They devastate priorities like education and energy and medical research. They would certainly slow our recovery and cost us hundreds of thousands of jobs. And that's why Democrats, Republicans, business leaders, and economists have already said that these cuts, known here in Washington as the sequester, are a really bad idea. Now, some in Congress have proposed preventing only the defense cuts by making even bigger cuts to things like education and job training, Medicare, and Social Security benefits. That idea is even worse. Yes, the biggest driver of our long-term debt is the rising cost of health care for an aging population. And those of us who care deeply about programs like Medicare must embrace the need for modest reforms. Otherwise, our retirement programs will crowd out the investments we need for our children and jeopardize the promise of a secure retirement for future generations. But we can't ask senior citizens and working families to shoulder the entire burden of deficit reduction while asking nothing more from the wealthiest and the most powerful. We won't grow the middle class simply by shifting the cost of health care or college onto families that are already struggling, or by forcing communities to lay off more teachers and more cops and more firefighters. Most Americans, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, understand that we can't just cut our way to prosperity. They know that broad-based economic growth requires a balanced approach to deficit reduction, with spending cuts and revenue, and with everybody doing their fair share. And that's the approach I offer tonight. On Medicare, I'm prepared to enact reforms that will achieve the same amount of health care savings by the beginning of the next decade as the reforms proposed by the bipartisan Simpson-Bowles Commission. Already, the Affordable Care Act is helping to slow the growth of health care costs. And the reforms I'm proposing go even further. We'll reduce taxpayer subsidies to prescription drug companies and ask more from the wealthiest seniors. We'll bring down costs by changing the way our government pays for Medicare, because our medical bills shouldn't be based on the number of tests ordered or days spent in the hospital. They should be based on the quality of care that our seniors receive. And I am open to additional reforms from both parties, so long as they don't violate the guarantee of a secure retirement. Our government shouldn't make promises we cannot keep, but we must keep the promises we've already made. To hit the rest of our deficit reduction target, we should do what leaders in both parties have already suggested and save hundreds of billions of dollars by getting rid of tax loopholes and deductions for the well-off and the well-connected. After all, why would we choose to make deeper cuts to education and Medicare just to protect special interest tax breaks? How is that fair? Why is the deficit reduction is a big emergency, justifying making cuts in Social Security benefits but not closing some loopholes? How does that promote growth? Now is our best chance for bipartisan, comprehensive tax reform that encourages job creation and helps bring down the deficit. We can get this done. The American people deserve a tax code that helps small businesses spend less time filling out complicated forms and more time expanding and hiring. A tax code that ensures billionaires with high-powered accountants can't work the system and pay a lower rate than their hard-working secretaries. A tax code that lowers incentives to move jobs overseas and lowers tax rates for businesses and manufacturers that are creating jobs right here in the United States of America. That's what tax reform can deliver. That's what we can do together. I realize that tax reform and entitlement reform will not be easy. The politics will be hard for both sides. None of us will get 100% of what we want. But the alternative will cost us jobs, hurt our economy, visit hardship on millions of hard-working Americans. So let's set party interests aside and work to pass a budget that replaces reckless cuts with smart savings and wise investments in our future. And let's do it without the brinksmanship that stresses consumers and scares off investors. The greatest nation on earth cannot keep conducting its business by drifting from one manufactured crisis to the next. We can't do it. Let's agree right here, right now, to keep the people's government open and pay our bills on time and always uphold the full faith and credit of the United States of America. The American people have worked too hard for too long, rebuilding from one crisis, to see their elected officials cause another. Now, most of us agree that a plan to reduce the deficit must be part of our agenda. But let's be clear. Deficit reduction alone is not an economic plan. A growing economy that creates good middle-class jobs, that must be the North Star that guides our efforts. Every day, we should ask ourselves three questions as a nation. How do we attract more jobs to our shores? How do we equip our people with the skills they need to get those jobs? And how do we make sure that hard work leads to a decent living? Now, a year and a half ago, I put forward an American Jobs Act that independent economists said would create more than 1 million new jobs. And I thank the last Congress for passing some of that agenda. I urge this Congress to pass the rest. But tonight I'll lay out additional proposals that are fully paid for and fully consistent with the budget framework both parties agreed to just 18 months ago. Let me repeat. Nothing I'm proposing tonight should increase our deficit by a single dime. It is not a bigger government we need, but a smarter government that sets priorities and invests in broad-based growth. That's what we should be looking for. Our first priority is making America a magnet for new jobs in manufacturing. After shedding jobs for more than 10 years, our manufacturers have added about 500,000 jobs over the past three. Caterpillar is bringing jobs back from Japan. Ford is bringing jobs back from Mexico. And this year, Apple will start making Macs in America again. There are things we can do right now to accelerate this trend. Last year, we created our first Manufacturing Innovation Institute in Youngstown, Ohio. A once-shuttered warehouse is now a state-of-the-art lab where new workers are mastering the 3D printing that has the potential to revolutionize the way we make almost everything. There's no reason this can't happen in other towns. So tonight, I'm announcing the launch of three more of these manufacturing hubs, where businesses will partner with the Department of Defense and Energy to turn regions left behind by globalization into global centers of high-tech jobs. And I ask this Congress to help create a network of 15 of these hubs and guarantee that the next revolution in manufacturing is made right here in America. We can get that done. Now, if we want to make the best products, we also have to invest in the best ideas. Every dollar we invested to map the human genome returned $140 to our economy. Every dollar. Today, our scientists are mapping the human brain to unlock the answers to Alzheimer's. They're developing drugs to regenerate damaged organs, devising new materials to make batteries 10 times more powerful. Now is not the time to gut these job-creating investments in science and innovation. Now is the time to reach a level of research and development not seen since the height of the space race. We need to make those investments. Today, no area holds more promise than our investments in American energy. After years of talking about it, we're finally poised to control our own energy future. We produce more oil at home than we have in 15 years. We have doubled the distance our cars will go on a gallon of gas and the amount of renewable energy we generate from sources like wind and solar, with tens of thousands of good American jobs to show for it. We produce more natural gas than ever before. And nearly everyone's energy bill is lower because of it. And over the last 4 years, our emissions of the dangerous carbon pollution that threatens our planet have actually fallen. But for the sake of our children and our future, we must do more to combat climate change. Now, it's true that no single event makes a trend. But the fact is, the 12 hottest years on record have all come in the last 15. Heat waves, droughts, wildfires, floods, all are now more frequent and more intense. We can choose to believe that Superstorm Sandy and the most severe drought in decades and the worst wildfires some states have ever seen were all just a freak coincidence. Or we can choose to believe in the overwhelming judgment of science and act before it's too late. Now, the good news is we can make meaningful progress on this issue while driving strong economic growth. I urge this Congress to get together, pursue a bipartisan market-based solution to climate change, like the one John McCain and Joe Lieberman worked on together a few years ago. But if Congress won't act soon to protect future generations, I will. I will direct my cabinet to come up with executive actions we can take now and in the future to reduce pollution, prepare our communities for the consequences of climate change, and speed the transition to more sustainable sources of energy. And 4 years ago, other countries dominated the clean energy market and the jobs that came with it. And we've begun to change that. Last year, wind energy added nearly half of all new power capacity in America. So let's generate even more. Solar energy gets cheaper by the year. Let's drive down costs even further. As long as countries like China keep going all in on clean energy, so must we. Now, in the meantime, the natural gas boom has led to cleaner power and greater energy independence. We need to encourage that. And that's why my administration will keep cutting red tape and speeding up new oil and gas permits. That's got to be part of an all-of-the-above plan. But I also want to work with this Congress to encourage the research and technology that helps natural gas burn even cleaner and protects our air and our water. In fact, much of our newfound energy is drawn from lands and waters that we, the public, own together. So tonight I propose we use some of our oil and gas revenues to fund an energy security trust that will drive new research and technology to shift our cars and trucks off oil for good. If a nonpartisan coalition of CEOs and retired generals and admirals can get behind this idea, then so can we. Let's take their advice and free our families and businesses from the painful spikes in gas prices we put up with for far too long. I'm also issuing a new goal for America. Let's cut in half the energy wasted by our homes and businesses over the next 20 years. We'll work with the states to do it. Those states with the best ideas to create jobs and lower energy bills by constructing more efficient buildings will receive federal support to help make that happen. America's energy sector is just one part of an aging infrastructure badly in need of repair. Ask any CEO where they'd rather locate and hire: a country with deteriorating roads and bridges, or one with high-speed rail and internet, high-tech schools, self-healing power grids. The CEO of Siemens America, a company that brought hundreds of new jobs to North Carolina, said that if we upgrade our infrastructure, they'll bring even more jobs. And that's the attitude of a lot of companies all around the world. And I know you want these job-creating projects in your district. I've seen all those ribbon cuttings. So, tonight, I propose a fix-it-first program to put people to work as soon as possible on our most urgent repairs, like the nearly 70,000 structurally deficient bridges across the country. And to make sure taxpayers don't shoulder the whole burden, I'm also proposing a partnership to rebuild America that attracts private capital to upgrade what our businesses need most: modern ports to move our goods, modern pipelines to withstand a storm, modern schools worthy of our children. Let's prove there's no better place to do business than here in the United States of America, and let's start right away. We can get this done. And part of our rebuilding effort must also involve our housing sector. The good news is our housing market is finally healing from the collapse of 2007. Home prices are rising at the fastest pace in 6 years. Home purchases are up nearly 50%, and construction is expanding again. But even with mortgage rates near a 50-year low, too many families with solid credit who want to buy a home are being rejected. Too many families who never missed a payment and want to refinance are being told no. That's holding our entire economy back. We need to fix it. Right now, there's a bill in this Congress that would give every responsible homeowner in America the chance to save $3,000 a year by refinancing at today's rates. Democrats and Republicans have supported it before. So what are we waiting for? Take a vote and send me that bill. Why would we be against that? Why would that be a partisan issue? Helping folks refinance. Right now, overlapping regulations keep responsible young families from buying their first home. What's holding us back? Let's streamline the process and help our economy grow. Now, these initiatives in manufacturing, energy, infrastructure, housing, all these things will help entrepreneurs and small business owners expand and create new jobs. But none of it will matter unless we also equip our citizens with the skills and training to fill those jobs. And that has to start at the earliest possible age. You know, study after study shows that the sooner a child begins learning, the better he or she does down the road. But today, fewer than 3 in 10 four-year-olds are enrolled in a high-quality preschool program. Most middle-class parents can't afford a few hundred bucks a week for a private preschool. And for poor kids who need help the most, this lack of access to preschool education can shadow them for the rest of their lives. So tonight, I propose working with states to make high-quality preschool available to every single child in America. That's something we should be able to do. Every dollar we invest in high-quality early childhood education can save more than $7 later on by boosting graduation rates, reducing teen pregnancy, even reducing violent crime. In states that make it a priority to educate our youngest children, like Georgia or Oklahoma, studies show students grow up more likely to read and do math at grade level, graduate high school, hold a job, form more stable families of their own. We know this works. So let's do what works and make sure none of our children start the race of life already behind. Let's give our kids that chance. Let's also make sure that a high school diploma puts our kids on a path to a good job. Right now, countries like Germany focus on graduating their high school students with the equivalent of a technical degree from one of our community colleges. So those German kids, they're ready for a job when they graduate high school. They've been trained for the jobs that are there. Now at schools like PTEC in Brooklyn, a collaboration between New York Public Schools and City University of New York and IBM, students will graduate with a high school diploma and an associate's degree in computers or engineering. We need to give every American student opportunities like this. And 4 years ago, we started Race to the Top, a competition that convinced almost every state to develop smarter curricula and higher standards, all for about 1% of what we spend on education each year. Tonight, I'm announcing a new challenge to redesign America's high schools so they better equip graduates for the demands of a high-tech economy. And we'll reward schools that develop new partnerships with colleges and employers and create classes that focus on science, technology, engineering, and math. The skills today's employers are looking for to fill the jobs that are there right now and will be there in the future. Now, even with better high schools, most young people will need some higher education. It's a simple fact. The more education you've got, the more likely you are to have a good job and work your way into the middle class. But today's skyrocketing costs price too many young people out of a higher education or saddle them with unsustainable debt. Through tax credits, grants, and better loans, we've made college more affordable for millions of students and families over the last few years. But taxpayers can't keep on subsidizing higher and higher and higher costs for higher education. Colleges must do their part to keep costs down, and it's our job to make sure that they do. So tonight, I ask Congress to change the Higher Education Act so that affordability and value are included in determining which colleges receive certain types of federal aid. And tomorrow, my administration will release a new college scorecard that parents and students can use to compare schools based on a simple criteria: where you can get the most bang for your educational buck. Now, to grow our middle class, our citizens have to have access to the education and training that today's jobs require. But we also have to make sure that America remains a place where everyone who's willing to work, everybody who's willing to work hard, has the chance to get ahead. Our economy is stronger when we harness the talents and ingenuity of striving, hopeful immigrants. And right now, leaders from the business, labor, law enforcement, faith communities, they all agree that the time has come to pass comprehensive immigration reform. Now's the time to do it. Now's the time to get it done.
We're listening to President Obama's State of the Union address.
Now's the time to get it done. Real reform means stronger border security, and we can build on the progress my administration's already made, putting more boots on the southern border than at any time in our history, and reducing illegal crossings to their lowest levels in 40 years. Real reform means establishing a responsible pathway to earned citizenship, a path that includes passing a background check, paying taxes and a meaningful penalty, learning English, and going to the back of the line behind the folks trying to come here legally. And real reform means fixing the legal immigration system to cut waiting periods and attract the highly skilled entrepreneurs and engineers that will help create jobs and grow our economy. In other words, we know what needs to be done. And as we speak, bipartisan groups in both chambers are working diligently to draft a bill, and I applaud their efforts. So let's get this done. Send me a comprehensive immigration reform bill in the next few months, and I will sign it right away, and America will be better for it. Let's get it done. Let's get it done. But we can't stop there. We know our economy is stronger when our wives, our mothers, our daughters can live their lives free from discrimination in the workplace and free from the fear of domestic violence. Today, the Senate passed the Violence Against Women's Act that Joe Biden originally wrote almost 20 years ago, and I now urge the House to do the same.
Good job, Joe.
Yeah. And I ask this Congress to declare that women should earn a living equal to their efforts. And finally pass the Paycheck Fairness Act this year. We know our economy is stronger when we reward an honest day's work with honest wages. But today, a full-time worker making the minimum wage earns $14,500 a year. Even with the tax relief we put in place, a family with two kids that earns the minimum wage still lives below the poverty line. That's wrong. That's why, since the last time this Congress raised the minimum wage, 19 states have chosen to bump theirs even higher. Tonight, let's declare that in the wealthiest nation on earth, no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty, and raise the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour. We should be able to get that done. This single step would raise the incomes of millions of working families. It could mean the difference between groceries or the food bank, rent or eviction, scraping by or finally getting ahead. For businesses across the country, it would mean customers with more money in their pockets. And a whole lot of folks out there would probably need less help from government. In fact, working folks shouldn't have to wait year after year for the minimum wage to go up, while CEO pay has never been higher. So here's an idea that Governor Romney and I actually agreed on last year. Let's tie the minimum wage to the cost of living so that it finally becomes a wage you can live on. Tonight, let's also recognize that there are communities in this country where, no matter how hard you work, it is virtually impossible to get ahead. Factory towns decimated from years of plants packing up. Inescapable pockets of poverty, urban and rural, where young adults are still fighting for their first job. America is not a place where the chance of birth or circumstance should decide our destiny. And that's why we need to build new ladders of opportunity into the middle class for all who are willing to climb them. Let's offer incentives to companies that hire Americans who've got what it takes to fill that job opening but have been out of work so long that no one will give them a chance anymore. Let's put people back to work rebuilding vacant homes in rundown neighborhoods. And this year, my administration will begin to partner with 20 of the hardest-hit towns in America to get these communities back on their feet. Now, we'll work with local leaders to target resources at public safety and education and housing. We'll give new tax credits to businesses that hire and invest. And we'll work to strengthen families by removing the financial deterrence to marriage for low-income couples and do more to encourage fatherhood. Because what makes you a man isn't the ability to conceive a child, it's having the courage to raise one. And we want to encourage that. We want to help that. Stronger families, stronger communities, a stronger America. It is this kind of prosperity, broad, shared, built on a thriving middle class, that has always been the source of our progress at home. It's also the foundation of our power and influence throughout the world. Tonight, we stand united in saluting the troops and civilians who sacrifice every day to protect us. Because of them, we can say with confidence that America will complete its mission in Afghanistan and achieve our objective of defeating the core of Al-Qaeda. Already, we have brought home 33,000 of our brave servicemen and women. This spring, our forces will move into a support role, while Afghan security forces take the lead. Tonight, I can announce that over the next year, another 34,000 American troops will come home from Afghanistan. This drawdown will continue, and by the end of next year, our war in Afghanistan will be over. Beyond 2014, America's commitment to a unified and sovereign Afghanistan will endure. But the nature of our commitment will change. We're negotiating an agreement with the Afghan government that focuses on two missions: training and equipping Afghan forces so that the country does not again slip into chaos, and counterterrorism efforts that allow us to pursue the remnants of al-Qaeda and their affiliates. Today, the organization that attacked us on 9/11 is a shadow of its former self. It's true, different al-Qaeda affiliates and extremist groups have emerged from the Arabian Peninsula to Africa. The threat these groups pose is evolving. But to meet this threat, we don't need to send tens of thousands of our sons and daughters abroad or occupy other nations. Instead, we'll need to help countries like Yemen, Libya, and Somalia provide for their own security and help allies who take the fight to terrorists, as we have in Mali. And where necessary, through a range of capabilities, we will continue to take direct action against those terrorists who pose the gravest threat to Americans. Now, as we do, we must enlist our values in the fight. That's why my administration has worked tirelessly to forge a durable legal and policy framework to guide our counterterrorism efforts. Throughout, we have kept Congress fully informed of our efforts. And I recognize that in our democracy, no one should just take my word for it that we're doing things the right way. So in the months ahead, I will continue to engage Congress to ensure not only that our targeting, detention, and prosecution of terrorists remains consistent with our laws and system of checks and balances, but that our efforts are even more transparent to the American people and to the world. Of course, our challenges don't end with al-Qaeda. America will continue to lead the effort to prevent the spread of the world's most dangerous weapons. The regime in North Korea must know they will only achieve security and prosperity by meeting their international obligations. Provocations of the sort we saw last night will only further isolate them. As we stand by our allies, strengthen our own missile defense, and lead the world in taking firm action in response to these threats. Likewise, the leaders of Iran must recognize that now's the time for a diplomatic solution, because a coalition stands united in demanding that they meet their obligations, and we will do what is necessary to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon. At the same time, we'll engage Russia to seek further reductions in our nuclear arsenals and continue leading the global effort to secure nuclear materials that could fall into the wrong hands. Because our ability to influence others depends on our willingness to lead and meet our obligations. America must also face the rapidly growing threat from cyber attacks. Now, we know hackers steal people's identities and infiltrate private emails. We know foreign countries and companies swipe our corporate secrets. Now our enemies are also seeking the ability to sabotage our power grid, our financial institutions, our air traffic control systems. We cannot look back years from now and wonder why we did nothing in the face of real threats to our security and our economy. And that's why earlier today, I signed a new executive order that will strengthen our cyber defenses by increasing information sharing and developing standards to protect our national security, our jobs, and our privacy. But now Congress must act as well by passing legislation to give our government a greater capacity to secure our networks and deter attacks. This is something we should be able to get done on a bipartisan basis. Now, even as we protect our people, we should remember that today's world presents not just dangers, not just threats, it presents opportunities. To boost American exports, support American jobs, and level the playing field in the growing markets of Asia, we intend to complete negotiations on a Trans-Pacific Partnership. And tonight I'm announcing that we will launch talks on a comprehensive transatlantic trade and investment partnership with the European Union, because trade that is fair and free across the Atlantic supports millions of good-paying American jobs. We also know that progress in the most impoverished parts of our world enriches us all, not only because it creates new markets, more stable order in certain regions of the world, but also because it's the right thing to do. You know, in many places, people live on little more than a dollar a day. So the United States will join with our allies to eradicate such extreme poverty in the next two decades by connecting more people to the global economy, by empowering women, by giving our young and brightest minds new opportunities to serve, and helping communities to feed, empower, and educate themselves, by saving the world's children from preventable deaths, and by realizing the promise of an AIDS-free generation, which is within our reach. You see, America must remain a beacon to all who seek freedom during this period of historic change. I saw the power of hope last year in Rangoon, in Burma, when Aung San Suu Kyi welcomed an American president into the home where she had been imprisoned for years. When thousands of Burmese lined the streets waving American flags, including a man who said, "There is justice and law in the United States. I want our country to be like that." In defense of freedom, we'll remain the anchor of strong alliances from the Americas to Africa, from Europe to Asia. In the Middle East, we will stand with citizens as they demand their universal rights and support stable transitions to democracy. We know the process will be messy, and we cannot presume to dictate the course of change in countries like Egypt. But we can and will insist on respect for the fundamental rights of all people. We'll keep the pressure on a Syrian regime that has murdered its own people and support opposition leaders that respect the rights of every Syrian. And we will stand steadfast with Israel in pursuit of security and a lasting peace. These are the messages I'll deliver when I travel to the Middle East next month. And all this work depends on the courage and sacrifice of those who serve in dangerous places at great personal risk. Our diplomats, our intelligence officers, and the men and women of the United States Armed Forces. As long as I'm Commander-in-Chief, we will do whatever we must to protect those who serve their country abroad, and we will maintain the best military the world has ever known. We'll invest in new capabilities, even as we reduce waste and wartime spending. We will ensure equal treatment for all service members and equal benefits for their families, gay and straight. We will draw upon the courage and skills of our sisters and daughters and moms because women have proven under fire that they are ready for combat. We will keep faith with our veterans, investing in world-class care, including mental health care, for our wounded warriors. Supporting our military families, giving our veterans the benefits and education and job opportunities that they have earned. And I want to thank my wife, Michelle, and Dr. Jill Biden for their continued dedication to serving our military families as well as they have served us. Thank you, honey. Thank you, Jill. Defending our freedom, though, is not just the job of our military alone. We must all do our part to make sure our God-given rights are protected here at home. That includes one of the most fundamental rights of a democracy, the right to vote. When any American, no matter where they live or what their party, are denied that right because they can't afford to wait for 5 or 6 or 7 hours just to cast their ballot, we are betraying our ideals. So tonight I'm announcing a nonpartisan commission to improve the voting experience in America, and it definitely needs improvement. I'm asking 2 longtime experts in the field, who, by the way, recently served as the top attorneys for my campaign and for Governor Romney's campaign, to lead it. We can fix this, and we will. The American people demand it, and so does our democracy. Of course, what I've said tonight matters little if we don't come together to protect our most precious resource, our children. It has been 2 months since Newtown. I know this is not the first time this country has debated how to reduce gun violence, but this time is different. Overwhelming majorities of Americans who believe in the Second Amendment, have come together around common sense reform, like background checks that will make it harder for criminals to get their hands on a gun. Senators of both parties are working together on tough new laws to prevent anyone from buying guns for resale to criminals. Police chiefs are asking our help to get weapons of war and massive ammunition magazines off our streets because these police chiefs, they're tired of seeing their guys and gals being outgunned. Each of these proposals deserves a vote in Congress. If you want to vote no, that's your choice. But these proposals deserve a vote. Because in the 2 months since Newtown, more than 1,000 birthdays, graduations, anniversaries have been stolen from our lives by a bullet from a gun. more than 1,000. One of those we lost was a young girl named Hydea Pendleton. She was 15 years old. She loved Fig Newtons and lip gloss. She was a majorette. She was so good to her friends, they all thought they were her best friend. Just 3 weeks ago, she was here in Washington with her classmates, performing for her country at my inauguration. And a week later, she was shot and killed in a Chicago park after school, just a mile away from my house. Hydea's parents, Nate and Cleo, are in this chamber tonight, along with more than 24 Americans whose lives have been torn apart by gun violence. They deserve a vote. They deserve a vote. They deserve a vote. Gabby Giffords deserves a vote. The families of Newtown deserve a vote. The families of Aurora deserve a vote. The families of Oak Creek and Tucson and Blacksburg and the countless other communities ripped open by gun violence, they deserve a simple vote. They deserve a simple vote. Our actions will not prevent every senseless act of violence in this country. In fact, no laws, no initiatives, no administrative acts will perfectly solve all the challenges I've outlined tonight. But we were never sent here to be perfect. We were sent here to make what difference we can, to secure this nation, expand opportunity, uphold our ideals through the hard, often frustrating, but absolutely necessary work of self-government. We were sent here to look out for our fellow Americans the same way they look out for one another every single day, usually without fanfare, all across this country. We should follow their example. We should follow the example of a New York City nurse named Menchu Sanchez. When Hurricane Sandy plunged her hospital into darkness, she wasn't thinking about how her own home was faring. Her mind was on the 20 precious newborns in her care and the rescue plan she devised that kept them all safe. We should follow the example of a North Miami woman named Desalene Victor. When Desalene arrived at her polling place, she was told the wait to vote might be 6 hours. And as time ticked by, her concern was not with her tired body or aching feet, but whether folks like her would get to have their say. And hour after hour, a throng of people stayed in line to support her, because Desalene is 102 years old. And they erupted in cheers when she finally put on a sticker that read, "I voted." Well, there's Desalene. We should follow the example of a police officer named Brian Murphy. When a gunman opened fire on a Sikh temple in Wisconsin, Brian was the first to arrive, and he did not consider his own safety. He fought back until help arrived and ordered his fellow officers to protect the safety of the fellow Americans worshiping inside, even as he lay bleeding from 12 bullet wounds. And when asked how he did that, Brian said, "That's just the way we're made. That's just the way we're made. We may do different jobs and wear different uniforms and hold different views than the person beside us. But as Americans, we all share the same proud title. We are citizens. It's a word that doesn't just describe our nationality or our legal status. It describes the way we're made. It describes what we believe. It captures the enduring idea that this country only works when we accept certain obligations to one another and to future generations. That our rights are wrapped up in the rights of others. And that well into our third century as a nation, it remains the task of us all, as citizens of these United States, to be the authors of the next great chapter of our American story. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless these United States of America."
We've been listening to President Barack Obama delivering the first State of the Union address of his second term. I'm Melissa Block. The president spoke for just about an hour, the vast majority of that time on domestic issues, by my count, about 11 minutes spent on foreign policy. And we'll be bringing you the Republican response from Florida Senator Marco Rubio when that happens in just a few moments. But let's talk now about the president's address. And to do that with some analysis, I'm joined once again by NPR's Mara Liasson. And also here with me in the studio are Andres Martinez, editorial director of the New America Foundation. Andres, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And also syndicated columnist Mona Charon, who worked in the Reagan White House and is a speechwriter for Jack Kent. Mona, welcome to you.
Glad to be here.
Mona, there were a couple of points in that speech where you said, "I predicted this. I knew he was going to talk about this." What were you talking about?
Well, I did predict that he would say that the economy has been damaged by the high wire act of Congress and the president not being able to agree on budget negotiations and fiscal cliffs and whatnot. Actually, he was a little less partisan and pointed than I was expecting on that point, and on several others. That much having been said, this was still a speech that had more than its share of straw men. And I can itemize them if you'd like.
Yeah, let's get back to that in just a second. But let me bring Andres in here as well. Were you hearing a very different tone than maybe that you heard a few weeks ago in the inaugural address? There were a number of pitches for bipartisan agreement, the common theme that the president kept repeating, "We can get this done, let's get it done, we should be able to get that done."
Yes, I think if you didn't follow politics closely and you tuned in, you would wonder what the nature of the opposition is. There must be some invisible force that causes things not to happen. Because by my count, he mentioned Republicans by name or just the term Republicans about 8 or 9 times, and it was always to say, "We agree on these things." Speaking of straw men, there was one reference to some in Congress oppose this or that. But generally, it was all about these are all sensible ideas that we can all agree with. He even reached out to say that he'd agreed with Governor Romney on something. It was an effort to be as nonpartisan as one could be. It was quite striking, I found.
And Mona, the straw men that you were thinking about, what were they?
He said, for example, that we were for research and R&D. He talked about electric cars. Actually, he didn't talk about the electric cars. He talked about the clean energy. But in point of fact, when we invest in, or when the government forces investment in things like wind power, the price of energy inevitably goes up. And who pays that price is the people who are on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale. It hits them harder than it does other people. He failed to mention that. He talked about universal preschool. Mm-hmm. Who could be against that? But, of course, he said, "We're going to work with the states to do this." He didn't mention that since 1970, we have tripled spending on education in real dollars, and we've seen scores have flatlined. So this is just another liberal nostrum that hasn't worked.
Let's take a pause here for just 1 second, because I want to bring into the conversation Republican Congressman Tom Cole of Oklahoma. He's the Deputy Majority Whip for the Republican Conference. Congressman Cole, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Anything you heard that you liked in the president's speech tonight?
Yeah, there were a number of things. Well, it's like most speeches the president's given, the sense that, look, it's always very polished. He's smooth. He's a wonderful orator, and he's quite eloquent at many points. The things that I liked what I heard on the immigration issue, and he got a very bipartisan response.
And you think there's a bipartisan path forward on that?
I actually do think so. I think it'll be tough, but I'm very encouraged by what I'm seeing in the Senate and in the House in a bipartisan sense, and it's really individual members coming together. It's interesting to me. I don't want to be overly critical of the president on his night, but he told us we would have a comprehensive bill over 4 years ago when he was running in 2008. We haven't seen that, but I think, honestly, this is one where Congress has come together and seen the need to act, and we at least see the outline.
I want to ask you...
particularly pleased that the president pointed to the bipartisan passage of the Violence Against Women Act, mm-hmm. and we need to do that in the House. We're very close. We have a division over tribal issues and tribal jurisdictions that I think are very important.
It's a big issue in your state of Oklahoma, I know. I want to ask you, Congressman, about sequestration. You said yesterday these cuts are in law. They're going to happen. Do you think that there's a way to bypass the sequestration?
What the president had to say. Look, we're 2.5 weeks away. He's yet to put a plan on the table. This was pretty general stuff. There were no specific things. To say we're going to move in a balanced way is well and good, but 45 days ago, he got an enormous revenue increase. I helped vote for that. I voted for the fiscal cliff deal, but there were no spending cuts in that. So the idea that there would now have to be revenue with spending cuts 45 days later, when one deal was unbalanced and this one has to be, I think flies in the face of practicality and political reality. So I think we're going to have a really tough fight over that particular issue. And longer term, I don't think the president really recognizes the severity of the debt crisis and the need for entitlement reform. And the ultimate key, not just to the sequestration, but much more importantly, down the line to the continuing resolution to extend government spending, the debt ceiling, and just the fiscal health of the country, is to come to grips with those kinds of problems.
Are you saying that any revenue increases, say increasing taxes on dividend income, that's completely off the table? The president asked, why is that fair?
Literally 45 days ago, raised the taxes on dividend and made that tax rate permanent law. And that was the president's proposal. I mean, that's the fiscal cliff. So you can't propose something, say, I want this to be permanent, and literally 45 days later on that particular item, change it. So I'm not saying that there's no way forward. I think the president is right that longer term tax reform, where you lower rates but eliminate a lot of deductions at the same time, makes a lot of sense. And in principle, both sides agree. But sequestration, is coming within weeks. There's not time to do tax reform. So having just had a major revenue increase, on this one, we really need to belly up to the bar on spending cuts. I would prefer that we do a lot more of them out of non-discretionary spending. We would be more than happy to work with the president on redistributing the cuts that are in law. But they are in law, and they will occur.
What about what the president had to say tonight on gun control? He said, if you want to vote no on these proposals, vote no. These proposals deserve a vote. And there seemed to be a cheer or a chant going up in the chamber, vote, vote, vote.
Oh, I never have a problem in voting on things. I mean, I do think you're sent here to vote. So if you're not willing to make tough decisions, you're in the wrong business. So I have no problem with whatever gets through committees and has votes. I do think there's some areas of agreement. There's a lot of areas of disagreement, and some of this is geographic and cultural as well as partisan. So, again, I'm happy if we can find common ground. I certainly never have a problem with voting on things. So, again, I think the Senate's probably the arena. We'll see what actually comes out of the Senate. I think it's going to be much more difficult in the Senate than perhaps the president anticipates. I don't see a huge appetite from the Democratic Senate leadership, and I see a lot of Democrats in frankly very red states running for re-election. They're concerned about the issue. So where they go, what they feel comfortable with, I don't know yet, but we'll see what comes out of the Senate, and then I have no doubt the House will take it up, and the issue will be thoroughly debated, as it should be.
Congressman Cole, we're waiting for the Republican response from Florida Senator Marco Rubio. There also, we should mention, is a Tea Party response being delivered tonight by Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. What does that say about the state of your party if you have two competing responses to the president?
Oh, I guess I'm not too worried about the state of the party. Look, sometimes when you're in opposition, and in this sense we are, the Democrats have the Senate and the White House, we have the House. But we have 30 governors and control of the House chamber, and the idea that we're somehow riven and divided, I think, is probably not the case. We're going through a reflective time after losing a very close election. Remember, the president was reelected with a lower percentage, lower popular vote, fewer electoral votes than he did when he won in 2008. So it doesn't sound to me like he's expanded his influence. He probably deepened it, but actually in terms of percentage of people, he got a smaller vote than he did 4 years ago, and it was a much more competitive election. So we need to make some changes, and we need to do some soul-searching, but we're not in an existential crisis on the Republican side of the aisle.
We have seen your speaker, though, John Boehner, have a really hard time getting measures, getting his caucus to agree to measures that he supports. There's been real division
there. That's true. I think because our people are very intent on the debt crisis, and they want to go further. I mean, most of the votes we lose on things like that are because people are more adamant about dealing with things. It's not because they're moving toward the president. It's actually because they're moving away from. I actually think the speaker deserves a lot of credit. I mean, he put the fiscal cliff deal on the floor and voted for it himself. He didn't have to do that. He did the same thing with Hurricane Sandy. He didn't vote for it in that case. That speakers don't normally vote, but he put it on the floor, and Eric Cantor voted for that. So I think we're willing to work with the president. I think we've demonstrated that. But look, you have political parties for a reason. We have competing visions and competing values, so there's going to be disagreement.
Congressman Cole, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for the invitation.
That's Republican Congressman Tom Cole of Oklahoma. Let me go back here in the studio to Mara Liasson and also Mona Charon and Andres Martinez before we turn to the Republican response from Marco Rubio. And Mara, highlight for you of the speech, anything surprising in there for you?
Well, I guess what was surprising is that I think he did change his tone. It's interesting. Usually inaugural addresses are the time when you say a new chapter is beginning and you reach across the aisle and you talk about a time of renewal. And then you can be more partisan in a State of the Union address. I think he did the opposite. Right. I think he really dialed it back. I don't know if he did it in response to the reviews he got for the inaugural address, but he started right out with the budget and the deficit. Many Republicans thought that he was giving the back of his hand to entitlement reform in the inaugural address and he didn't care about it anymore. But he did say, you know, those of us who care deeply about programs like Medicare, speaking to fellow Democrats, must embrace the need for modest reforms. Otherwise, our retirement programs will crowd out the investments that Democrats want for future generations. So I thought that was important. It sounds like he's signaling he still wants a deal. He didn't say specifically what he'd do to Medicare beyond what he's already proposed. He didn't kind of poke at Paul Ryan and talk about a nation of takers. He tried to give a kind of gracious shout out to Governor Romney when he talked about raising the minimum wage to $9. So I thought that he was trying to offer some olive branches to the other side.
Mona Charon, did you hear those same olive branches that Mara's talking about?
Well, what strikes me is that there was nothing in this speech where he was dealing with the economy, where he focused on what the country most desperately needs, which is growth. This president doesn't really know how to promote growth. He thought he was doing it in his first 4 years. He thought the stimulus and all of the rest of the government and what he likes to call investments would by now have created a thriving economy. And instead, the economy is desperately, desperately struggling. And so he did not offer anything that will promote the kind of growth that will make those entitlement cuts and reforms palatable or at least possible for the vast majority of the American people.
Andres Martinez, I think you're going to get the last word before we hear from Senator Rubio here.
I heard a lot of talk of promoting growth, whether it was the trade agenda that Republicans have traditionally backed, whether it was on energy. He pointed out that corporate profits have never been higher. So the growth is there. It hasn't been spread equitably, but it's definitely there. And I think his whole speech was framed around ways to get the growth rate, which is modest. And he talked about how we've cleared the rubble from the crisis, which I thought was a nice way to to frame it, to take us to a more ambitious, robust, 3% GDP growth as opposed to something approximating 2.
Thanks so much. That's Andres Martinez, editorial director with the New America Foundation. Also heard from syndicated columnist Mona Charon and NPR's Mara Liasson. And we're going to go now to the Republican response that we mentioned from Florida Senator Marco Rubio, 41 years old, first-term senator from Florida, a Cuban-American, son of immigrants, former Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives, and a darling of the Tea Party who has now been recently on the cover of Time magazine, who calls him a Republican savior. He will be delivering the Republican response to the president's State of the Union address. Here's Senator Rubio.
Good evening. I'm Marco Rubio. I'm blessed to represent Florida in the United States Senate. Let me begin by congratulating President Obama on the start of his second term. Tonight, I have the honor of responding to a State of the Union address on behalf of my fellow Republicans. And I'm especially honored to be addressing our brave men and women serving in the armed forces and in diplomatic posts around the world. You may be thousands of miles away, but you are always in our prayers. The State of the Union address is always a reminder of how unique America is. See, for much of human history, most people were trapped in stagnant societies where a tiny minority always stayed on top, and no one else even had a chance. But America's exceptional because we believe that every life at every stage is precious, and that everyone everywhere has a God-given right to go as far as their talents and hard work will take them. Like most Americans, for me, this ideal is personal. My parents immigrated here in pursuit of the opportunity to improve their life and to give their children the chance at an even better one. They made it to the middle class, my dad working as a bartender and my mother as a cashier and a maid. I didn't inherit any money from them, but I inherited something far better, the real opportunity to accomplish my dreams. This opportunity to make it to the middle class or beyond, no matter where you start out in life, it isn't bestowed on us from Washington. It comes from a vibrant free economy where people can risk their own money to open a business, and when they succeed, they hire more people who in turn invest or spend their money they make helping others start a business and create jobs. Presidents in both parties, from John F. Kennedy to Ronald Reagan, have known that our free enterprise economy is the source of our middle-class prosperity. But President Obama, he believes it's the cause of our problems, that the economic downturn happened because our government didn't tax enough, spend enough, or control enough. And therefore, as you heard tonight, his solution to virtually every problem we face is for Washington to tax more, borrow more, and spend more. This idea that our problems were caused by a government that was too small, it's just not true. In fact, a major cause of our recent downturn was a housing crisis created by reckless government policies. And the idea that more taxes and more government spending is the best way to help hardworking middle-class taxpayers, that's an old idea that's failed every time it's been tried. More government isn't going to help you get ahead. It's going to hold you back. More government isn't going to create more opportunities. It's going to limit them. And more government isn't going to inspire new ideas, new businesses, and new private sector jobs. It's going to create uncertainty. Because more government breeds complicated rules and laws that small businesses can't afford to follow. Because more government raises taxes on employers who then pass the costs on to their employees through fewer hours, lower pay, and even layoffs. And because many government programs that claim to help the middle class often end up hurting them. For example, Obamacare. It was supposed to help middle-class Americans afford health insurance. But now some people are losing the health insurance they were happy with. And because Obamacare created expensive requirements for companies with more than 50 employees, now many of these companies aren't hiring. Not only that, they're being forced to lay people off and switch from full-time employees to part-time workers. Now, does this mean that there's no role for government? Of course not. It plays a crucial part in keeping us safe, enforcing rules and providing some security against the risks of modern life. But government's role is wisely limited by the Constitution, and it can't play its essential role when it ignores those limits. There are valid reasons to be concerned about the president's plan to grow our government. But anytime anyone opposes the president's agenda, he and his allies usually respond by falsely attacking their motives. When we point out that no matter how many job-killing laws we pass, our government can't control the weather, he accuses us of wanting dirty water and dirty air. When we suggest we strengthen our safety net programs by giving states more flexibility to manage them, he accuses us of wanting to leave the elderly and the disabled to fend for themselves. And tonight, he even criticized us for refusing to raise taxes to delay military cuts, cuts that were his idea in the first place. But his favorite attack of all is that those of us who don't agree with him, that we only care about rich people. Mr. President, I still live in the same working-class neighborhood I grew up in. My neighbors aren't millionaires. They're retirees who depend on Social Security and Medicare. They're workers who have to get up early tomorrow morning and go to work to pay the bills. They're immigrants who came here because they were stuck in poverty in the countries where the government dominated the economy. The tax increases and the deficit spending you propose will hurt middle-class families. It will cost them their raises. It will cost them their benefits. It may even cost some of them their jobs. And it will hurt seniors because it does nothing to save Medicare and Social Security. So, Mr. President, I don't oppose your plans because I want to protect the rich. I oppose your plans because I want to protect my neighbors. Hard-working, middle-class Americans who don't need us to come up with a plan to grow the government. They need a plan to grow the middle class. Economic growth is the best way to help the middle class. Unfortunately, our economy actually shrank during the last 3 months of 2012. But if we can get the economy to grow at just 4% a year, it would create middle-class jobs, and it would reduce our deficits by almost $4 trillion over the next decade. Tax increases can't do this. Raising taxes won't create private sector jobs, and there's no realistic tax increase that could lower our deficits by almost $4 trillion. That's why I hope the president will abandon his obsession with raising taxes and instead work with us to achieve real growth in our economy. One of the best ways to encourage growth is through our energy industry. Of course, solar and wind energy should be a part of our energy portfolio. But God also blessed us with America with abundant coal, oil, and natural gas. Instead of wasting more taxpayer money on so-called clean energy companies like Solyndra, let's open up more federal lands for safe and responsible exploration. And let's reform our energy regulations so that they're reasonable and based on common sense. If we can grow our energy industry, it will make us energy independent. It will create middle-class jobs, and it will help bring manufacturing back from places like China. Simplifying our tax code will also help the middle class because it will make it easier for small businesses to hire and grow. And we agree with the president. We should lower our corporate tax rate, which is one of the highest in the world, so that companies will start bringing their money and their jobs back here from overseas. We can also help grow our economy if we have a legal immigration system that allows us to attract and assimilate the world's best and brightest. We need a responsible permanent solution to the problem of those who are here illegally. But first, we must follow through on the broken promises of the past to secure our borders and enforce our laws. Helping the middle class grow will also require an education system that gives people the skills today's jobs entail and the knowledge that tomorrow's world will require. We need to incentivize local school districts to offer more advanced placement courses and more vocational and career training. And we need to give all parents, especially the parents of children with special needs, the opportunity to send their children to the school of their choice. And because college tuition costs have grown so fast, we need to change the way we pay for higher education. Now, I believe in federal financial aid. I couldn't have gone to college without it. But it's not just about spending more money. It's also about strengthening and modernizing them. The 21st century workforce should not be forced to accept 20th century education solutions. Today's students aren't only 18-year-olds. They're returning veterans. They're single parents who decide to get the education they need to earn a decent wage. And they're workers who have lost jobs that are never coming back and need to be retrained. We need student aid that does not discriminate against programs that non-traditional students rely on, like online courses or degree programs that give you credit for work experience. When I finished school, I owed over $100,000 in student loans, a debt I paid off just a few months ago. Today, many graduates face massive student loans. We must give students more information on the costs and benefits of the student loans they're taking out. All of these measures are key to helping grow the economy. Though we won't be able to sustain a vibrant middle class unless we solve our debt problem. Every dollar our government borrows is money that isn't being invested to create jobs. And the uncertainty created by the debt is one reason why many businesses aren't hiring. The president loves to blame the debt on President Bush, but President Obama has created more debt in 4 years than his predecessor did in 8. The real cause of our debt is that our government has been spending $1 trillion more than it takes in every year. That's why we need a balanced budget amendment. The biggest obstacle to balancing the budget are programs where spending is already locked in. One of these programs is Medicare. It's especially important to me. It provided my father the care he needed to battle cancer and ultimately to die with dignity. And it pays for the care my mother receives right now. I would never support any changes to Medicare that would hurt seniors like my mother. But anyone who's in favor of leaving Medicare exactly the way it is right now is in favor of bankrupting it. Republicans have offered a detailed, incredible plan that helps save Medicare without hurting today's retirees. Instead of playing politics with Medicare, when is the president going to offer his detailed plan to save it? Tonight would have been a good time for him to do it. Of course, we face other challenges as well. We were all heartbroken by the recent tragedy in Connecticut. We must effectively deal with the rise of violence in our country. But unconstitutionally undermining the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding Americans is not the way to do it. On foreign policy, America continues to be indispensable to the goal of global liberty, property, and safeguarding human rights. The world is a better place when America is the strongest nation on earth. But we can't remain powerful if we don't have an economy that can afford it. In the short time that I've been here in Washington, nothing has frustrated me more than false choices like the one the president laid out tonight. The choice isn't just between big government or big business. What we need is an accountable, efficient, and effective government that allows small and new businesses to create more middle-class jobs. We don't have to raise taxes to avoid the president's devastating cuts to our military. Republicans have passed a plan that replaces these cuts with responsible spending reforms. In order to balance our budget, the choice doesn't have to be either higher taxes or dramatic benefit cuts for those in need. Instead, we should grow our economy so that we can create new taxpayers, not new taxes. And so our government can afford to help those who truly cannot help themselves. And the truth is, every problem can't be solved by the government. Many are caused by the moral breakdown in our society. And the answer to these challenges lie primarily in our families and our faiths, not our politicians. Despite our differences, I know that both Republicans and Democrats love America. I pray we can come together to solve our problems, because the choices before us could not be more important. If we can get our economy healthy again, our children will be the most prosperous Americans ever. And if we do not, we will forever be known as the generation responsible for America's decline. At a time when one showdown after another ends in short-term deals that do little or nothing about our real problems, some are starting to believe that our government leaders just can't or won't make the right choices anymore. But our strength has never come from the White House or the Capitol. It's always come from our people. A people united by the American idea that if you have a dream and you're willing to work hard, nothing should be impossible. Americans have always celebrated and been inspired by those who succeed. But it's the dreams of those who are still trying to make it that sets our nation apart. Tonight, all across this land, parents will hold their newborn children in their arms for the first time. For many of these parents, life has not gone the way they had planned. Maybe they were born into circumstances they found difficult to escape. Maybe they've made some mistakes along the way. Maybe their young mother's all alone, the father of their child long gone. But tonight, when they look into the eyes of their child for the first time, their lives will change forever. Because in those eyes, they will see what my parents saw in me and what your parents saw in you. They will see all the hopes and dreams they once had for themselves. This dream of a better life for their children, it's the hope of parents everywhere. Politicians here and throughout the world have long promised that more government can make those dreams come true. But we Americans have always known better. From our earliest days, we embraced economic liberty. And because we did, America remains one of the few places on earth where dreams like these even have a chance. Each time our nation has faced great challenges, what has kept us together was our shared hope for a better life. Now, let that hope bring us together again to solve the challenges of our time and write the next chapter in the amazing story of the greatest nation man has ever known. Thank you for listening. May God bless all of you. May God bless our president. And may God continue to bless the United States of America.
That's Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida delivering the Republican rebuttal to President Obama's State of the Union address live from the Speaker's Conference Room in the Capitol, a speech he also recorded and released in Spanish for Spanish language media. I'm Melissa Block. You're listening to live special coverage from NPR News. And I'm joined once again by NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Mara, a lot of expectation riding on Marco Rubio's shoulders in hopes that he might turn Republican fortunes around with Hispanic voters.
Right. Well, with Hispanic voters, with young voters. Time magazine, I think, called him the savior of the Republican Party. I think that this is a very tough job to do the response to the State of the Union. Many people have tried and many have failed, mm-hmm. but I think Marco Rubio did a very good job tonight. And he was really doing two different things. One is, of course, he was trying to pre-butt, because he wrote the speech before he heard the president, what the president was saying. And I think some of that was a little bit off the mark, because the president didn't say all of the things that he said he did. However, the other part of his speech, which I think is even more important, was this was his debut on the national stage, and I think he acquitted himself very, very well. He was positive. He presented the kind of message that Republicans want to present. He was young. Being Hispanic helps a lot. He also wasn't mean in any way. He was magnanimous towards the president. He said, I know both Republicans and Democrats love America. And he told the emotional stories that he's very good at telling. And I've heard him do this in the past many times about his own family situation and relating to other parents and their children and their hopes and dreams and trying to argue that more government makes it harder to achieve those dreams. But the bottom line is Marco Rubio did himself a lot of good. Everyone in Washington assumes he's going to try to run for president in 2016, and this was a pretty good first step.
The son of a bartender and a maid. His response, by the way, to that Time magazine cover story was his tweet, there is only one savior, and it is not me, #Jesus, from Marco Rubio. Let's go now to Democratic Senator Mark Begich of Alaska. He's a member of the Senate Democratic leadership, and I believe he's joining us from Statuary Hall in the Capitol. Senator Begich, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
When you heard President Obama talk about avoiding the sequester and including revenue as part of the equation, some of what's been on the table is ending tax loopholes for oil and gas companies, which are a huge interest in your state, something you've opposed. Do you still oppose those?
Absolutely. I'll continue to oppose it, because my view on that is that as we take individual items like that, we shouldn't cherry pick them off. We should leave those for a larger issue of tax reform, which, as you know, the president talked about that. I have proposed a bipartisan bill with another Democrat, another Republican last cycle in regards to tax reform. So, you know, those are the issues that I think are best laid to not pick out one company over another or one industry over another. But let's have those all in the tax reform debate. So if it's part of sequester, that's going to be a problem for me, as it has been in the past. But I think the broader sweep on tax reform, again, the president making that statement, if you saw, which I thought was very, encouraging, was Democrats and Republicans, House and Senate, standing up and applauding for that.
You did hear the president ask, you know, why is it fair to make deeper cuts to education and Medicare to protect special interest tax breaks, likely like those to the oil and gas companies?
Well, I think you could look at a broader sweep on this issue, and that is, you know, as you know, we've had this debate on sequester, which I know the response was just given by Marco Rubio, and it made it sound like the president came up with all this magic on sequester. Some people have amnesia. That was all voted on by bipartisan groups on the House and Senate. Everyone participated in that decision, and these are tough decisions. The reality on budget cuts and how we're going to manage this deficit that has grown over many years and the debt is it's going to take cuts, it's going to take revenue, and it's going to take investment. And that's what we have to deal with here. So people who want to, you know, pit one side against another, these decisions are going to be very difficult, and we're going to have to sit down together. And there are cuts, and I've proposed several that I think can be done very easily and save millions and millions of dollars. And that's what we're going to have to do. Now that, you know, tonight we got a blueprint. It wasn't the details. We'll see what those lay out, but they have to have cuts, revenue, and investment together.
Very briefly, do you see a way to avoid the sequester that's heading your way in a few weeks, heading America's way in a few weeks?
Well, I think it's going to be difficult. I think one of the pieces of the equation is getting all the parties together. Sometimes it has to be a rough road to get to a final answer, and we're kind of moving through that. But I will say, you know, what the president talked about on energy independence, those types of issues that bring jobs, bring revenue, bring opportunities for America are a good thing. His whole issue on education, educating our workforce, again, getting more people back to work, educating them for the new careers and opportunities that are in front of us, that's all important to grow this economy, start building what we think is an important way to get us out of this deficit and debt problem. We have some immediate short-term problems that are going to be tough to deal with, but once we deal with those, I think we have an incredible opportunity ahead of us. We saw a blueprint, a little bit of that tonight. Pieces I agree with, pieces I have some concerns about. But when you talk about education, infrastructure, energy, all good things, and also the one other thing, which is not part of the cuts and budget issue, is his statement on Afghanistan. You saw an incredible, unified, almost unified body saying, it's about time we get our troops out.
Okay, Senator Begich, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
That's Democratic Senator Mark Begich of Alaska. And we go now to Republican Senator John Thune of South Dakota, chair of the Senate Republican Conference, and also a member of the Budget Committee. Senator Thune, welcome to the program.
It's nice to be with you, Melissa.
Did you hear anything from the president tonight that you liked, that you'd be willing to throw your weight behind?
Well, you know, I think there were some things in his speech, obviously there always are, that are designed, I think, to reach out and try and generate some support across the aisle, some bipartisan cooperation on some of these issues. And, you know, clearly his mention of tax reform, a desire to do that, I think the talk about trade, some of his section on energy, there were things in there I think that would be very appealing to Republicans. So there were things in there, elements in his speech that I think will go over well. Obviously, he covered a lot of ground. There was a long laundry list, and there are a lot of things in there clearly that would have a hard time probably getting support up here too. But I think there's some ground there we can work with, and hopefully some things that we can do that will move us toward growing the economy, creating jobs, and getting things back on track. I think that's the thing that most Republicans wanted to hear this evening, is what is the president going to do about the economy and jobs. He mentioned going into the speech that they were going to pivot to economy and jobs. As somebody counted that up, and that's the eighth time that the president has said he's going to pivot. And it seems to me, at least, that's something he ought to not have to pivot back to. It's something he ought to stay focused on all the time, and I hope he will.
Senator Thune, one thing we haven't talked about in our coverage so far tonight is the allusion that President Obama made to the drone program without naming it. He said, no one should just take my word that we're doing things the right way. And there has been a lot of criticism recently about the drone program and how much Congress is in the loop. What did you think about what he said?
Right. Well, I think it's going to be really important going forward, especially in light of what's come out in the last couple of weeks, to make sure that that they're taking the steps that are necessary to keep members of Congress informed on what that program consists of and entails. And I think that there has been communication, at least with the intelligence committees and some of the relevant committees up here on Capitol Hill. But, you know, it was a bit of a surprise, I think, to a lot of people when the memo leaked and the instructions in there, or the detail that was given about how it's being used and what the criteria are, and it rightly, I think, set a lot of bells off around the country. So hopefully in the future they'll be a little bit more circumspect in making sure that members of Congress are more informed. And clearly it's been a very effective tool in battling Al-Qaeda, and I think it's something that when you're fighting a terrorist threat out there, you want to be able to do it in the most effective way, in a way that minimizes the amount of blood and treasure that we have to put forward from our country. And I think the drone program has been effective in that regard, but certainly I think they can do a much better job of transparency and accountability, and clearly that's the case with Congress.
Okay, Senator Thune, thanks so much.
Thank you. Good to be with you. Thanks, Melissa.
That's Republican Senator John Thune of South Dakota. And let's close out the hour with our commentators, Andres Martinez, Vice President of the New America Foundation, and syndicated columnist Mona Charon, here in our studio, along with NPR's Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. Final thoughts, Andres Martinez, on what you've heard tonight, both from the President and Senator Rubio.
I was struck, Melissa, by how they were both addressing different audiences, it felt like. The president was speaking to the middle of the country. It was not a very Washington partisan speech. I thought Senator Rubio, I would differ a bit from what Mara said. I thought his speech was very much of a Washington speech. The top of it was dedicated to not just attacking the president, but also criticizing the way that Democrats cast Republican opposition to the president. It felt like complaining about the refereeing. I think the Senator Rubio, who's a very compelling figure, has a very tough triangulating job to do here because he's really got out on a limb in supporting bipartisan immigration reform. He's come a long way. He has endorsed the notion of a pathway to citizenship for the undocumented 11 or 12 million people who are here. That has put him, I think, a little bit out of sorts with some of the base of the party. I think he was very cognizant of the fact that there was also going to be a Tea Party response, although interestingly, that isn't going to take on the immigration question centrally. That's not the source of contention.
But response from Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul.
Right, but I think looking ahead, he needs to solidify, he feels, his street cred with the base of the party, with that vocal minority. And so I think he's playing an interesting game here. I think he needed to address the base of the party far more so than the president obviously needed to address his base.
Mona Charon, as you listened to Marco Rubio, were you hearing the voice of the new Republican Party?
I think so. I think he did a very good job of doing something that was severely lacking from the Republican message in the campaign of 2012, and that is he made arguments. He said that government caused the housing crisis that so damaged the economy and brought about the financial crisis of 2008. He said that regarding Medicare, those who say that we cannot make any changes at all to the program are basically saying they want to bankrupt the program. He said, and he made the very touching, I think, sort of moving point that, you know, that there are millions of immigrants here who came here exactly because they want to escape an overly aggressive government in their countries of origin that have prevented their countries from having the prosperity that Americans have in the past enjoyed. So I found the arguments compelling, and the fact that he's willing to make arguments is refreshing and very necessary for Republicans going forward.
Let's turn to Ron Elving, our senior Washington editor, for some final thoughts, thinking back on the president's speech and what you heard from Senator Rubio.
Not many years ago, it would have been difficult for anyone in Washington to imagine that we would be sitting here in 2013.
I think I know where you're going with this.
Listening to an African-American president deliver his first State of the Union speech of his second term and hearing the response given by a Hispanic-American Republican who many people were calling the savior of the Republican Party and saying would be the 2016 nominee, not to anoint him quite yet. We don't want to get too premature here, but he's certainly a contender, and he certainly is changing the way that the Republican Party presents itself. I thought what was remarkable about his presentation was that he talked a lot about the opportunities they had in this country because of generous immigration policy for Cuban Americans, because of schools, because of student loans, huge amount of debt that he had to take on, government jobs that he's had, Medicare for his parents, a lot of government programs that have been very important to him in his life. And he represents a very different approach, really, from what the Republican Party might be traditionally associated with. But he still talks about more responsibility with regard to debt, more responsibility with respect to the size of government. So it'll be very interesting to see how he goes forward balancing those two personae.
Interesting. He I think said something like more government is what's holding you back. At the same time, he was listing a number of government programs that, as you say, helped him get ahead.
They don't seem
succeed.
To have held him back.
Yeah. I appreciate all of you being with us today. We have been listening to live special coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address and the Republican response. I'm Melissa Block. And I'm sorry we have a little more time to fill, so I'm going to go back to Ron Elving for a little bit more insight here. I apologize. Ron, as you look forward, a lot of deadlines heading our way in March.
That's right. We have, first of all, the March 1st sequester deadline. Then we have the will the government continue to fund itself deadline. Will there be a shutdown? And then finally, in May, we have the debt ceiling approaching once again. One of those three is going to result in some serious conflict between the parties and bring some kind of disruption. disruption, I think, to the country and the economy. Can't tell you which one yet.
Those manufactured crises that President Obama was referring to, we can't keep drifting from one manufactured crisis to the next, he said.
One thing we do continue to manufacture successfully here in America.
Okay. Thanks so much. Ron Elving, our senior Washington editor, also Mona Charon, syndicated columnist, and Andres Martinez, vice president of the New America Foundation. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
Thanks. And again, you've been listening to live special coverage of President Obama's State of the Union Address and the Republican response from Marco Rubio. I'm Melissa Block. Thanks for listening.